attaboy. Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle's on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super studcast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
Super Studcast cover wrestlers of all kinds and from everywhere. Super Studcast number 24 crosses the Atlantic Ocean to a beautiful spot in Wales to bring patrons a very different type of wrestler. People around the world are not sure what he is, and he doesn't mind. This is our first journey to the European continent to visit one of the strangest wrestlers in history. A dangerous shooter, singer, songwriter, book writer, actor, artist, and so much more. Part 1, now available, is absolutely fascinating as you meet one of the greatest wrestling stars in the world who conquered Europe and its champions long before arriving in America. This could only be one person on earth, the exotic one himself, Adrian Street. There has never been a Super Studcast like this one, and fan or not, you will not want to miss this piece of wrestling history. Part 2, covering his time in America, will be released on New Year's Eve. A total of 3 unforgettable hours.
Someone to adore, I've already given up my heart. And the love I have is all accounted for. I've fallen for a gorgeous work of art. When I want to see the fairest of them all and gaze into the sexy eyes of blue, I walk up to the full-length mirror on the wall. I take a breath and just admire the view.
I am in love with me. So in love with me.
It isn't hard to see why I am so in love with me.
He's in love, he's so in love.
Welcome, everybody, and patrons of the Super Studcast, this being Super Studcast number 24, the second part of our interview with a groundbreaking legend of the wrestling business who has been in the business for 62 years. I'm now going to throw it to our man, the Tennessee Stud himself, the legend Ron Fuller. Ron, we've got the exotic Adrian Street back for part 2.
Yes, and very glad to have him back for part 2. The response has been tremendous for part 1. People have just really been going crazy about it. I don't think they really realize the character and the type of guy that Adrian is. And this is really, really a pleasure to have him back for part 2. His life is so phenomenal, and his career in wrestling and everything else, that you can't hardly do it in 90 minutes. I'm not sure we could do it in 5 hours, to be quite honest with you, but we're going to have him here with us for the second part. And we kind of got as far as into a lot of things in Europe and a little bit of stuff in America. We're going to go back and pick up maybe just a couple of little more things that we did not get to, and asking him about his experience in Europe. And then we will we'll come to America. Adrian, you know, you probably have not had an opportunity to listen to it. We added to your deal. We added a little bit of your imagine what I could do to you song in the first one. And we opened this one with your other song, which is really a tremendous one, too. I'm in love with me. And, you know, it says a lot about just the titles of your song. You can pretty well tell where we're headed here today. So, this is just a real pleasure to have you with us, Adrian. And, you know, I'd like to get him on the phone. And I think you're there. Hopefully you are. And how are you doing today, Adrian?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks, Ron. And you reminded me, actually, when we were doing the intro talking about the music, that I only actually wrote and performed four songs in the UK. The fact that they used three of the four songs that I had in the movie Grunt that I was in kind of inspired me to write a book, Shake, Wrestle, and Roll. And I actually wrote the book, Shake, Wrestle, and Roll, and wrote all the rest of the songs while I was working for you in Florida and Alabama. In actual fact, I had a notebook with me, and if I wasn't driving, if one of you guys were driving me, taking us to the show, I'd sit there writing, and I wrote all the rest of the songs on the trips I was doing for you.
So pretty amazing, you know, that your talent is just everywhere. I mean, you write the songs, you sing the songs. I don't know if you play the music, but you've got pretty much most of it all done yourself. And I know that one group, the first ones that you put out was with Adrian Street and the Pile Drivers, which I love that name. That's a tremendous name. And I don't know if you did the second group with someone else.
They've just brought out my second album on Spotify. So if anybody wants to hear any of that, the actual album is called Naughty But It's Nice.
Cool. So, you know, at the end of the day's show, Adrian, we're going to give you some time to tell us what all you've got going. I mean, you have so much going right now. It's unbelievable. Movies and documentaries and releases of music, like you just talked about. And so we'll try to get that at the end of the program and let you have some time to just plug everything, because I have no idea what all you've got going. I mean, you're supposed to be in retirement, but you're kind of like me. You know, you're really not retired at this point, doesn't seem like. You're probably working pretty darn hard there.
Well, if anybody loves the business as much as we did, then you can never really leave it alone, you know?
Yeah, you don't get away from it. It never leaves your blood.
Once it's in your blood, once it's in your blood, it's like being bitten by a rattlesnake. It's there.
Yeah. Yes, it is. So, Adrian, we got a little bit into America last time, but I have a question that I did not get to last time. And this is a subject that you've probably talked about many, many times, but it was all new to me. I was looking at a little bit of your history, and I saw a story about a gentleman, and I don't know if I should even use the word gentleman when I refer to him, but Jimmy Savile. And I was wondering, you know, if you'd tell us a little bit about who he was, and I know you actually ended up in the ring with him.
Oh, Jimmy Savile.
Yes. Yeah, I may have pronounced it incorrectly.
Yeah, Jimmy Savile was a disc jockey. He really got over as a disc jockey. And he had a thing with the kids and everything like that, like Jim Will Fix It. And like if any young kids and everything like that made a wish, he'd sort of try to make it come true and everything, you know? And he was really over, but he wanted to put himself over as a tough guy. So he did all kinds of things. I mean, he sort of went into training with the Royal Marines because they have like a really tough schedule, you know. They have like a really tough form of training to actually make it as the Royal Marines. He did all that. He'd go on runs. He'd sort of do all kinds of things. Then there was a wrestler, gentleman Jim Lewis, actually brought him into the wrestling business on the independents, first of all. But the fact he was a big name, all of a sudden, joint promotions, some of the promoters in joint promotions started using him as a professional wrestler. And I had just had a match in Nottingham Ice Rink with the world lightweight champion, George Kidd. And not only did I beat George Kidd, it was a non-title match, unfortunately. Not only did I beat him in 7 minutes. And bearing in mind that like 30, 45 minutes was like normal length time for for matches in Britain in those days, because very often, unless it is a big show, they'd only ever have four matches on, like to sort of fill a whole evening with. This is a big show in Nottingham Irish Rink. Not only did I beat the lightweight champion of the world in a non-title match, but I beat him in 7 minutes, and he ended up, he had to go to a hospital because I'd sort of really did his legs in. He ended up in Nottingham Infirmary. Anyway, I challenged him to a title match, but he wasn't well enough. I'd hurt his legs that bad. He wasn't well enough to actually wrestle on the next show in Nottingham Irish Rink. He used to be, he used to have it once a month there. So I was there on the next show, and I expected him to put me on with somebody, you know, somebody good, somebody meaningful. I couldn't believe it when I turned up. They actually had me wrestling with Jimmy Savile. I was absolutely horrified. Then the next thing is Ted Beresford, who was the promoter, came into my dressing room with Jimmy Savile, introduced me to him. He said, "This is your opponent tonight." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I know." I said, "I got a bone to pick with you over that." Then he turned around. You won't believe this. He wanted me to fix the fight, and he wanted me to do a draw. He said, "You get one fall each." He wanted me to do a draw, actually. You actually want me to fix a bloody fight and actually do a draw with a bloody dish jockey after I'd just beaten the world champion. Well, there was no way I'd have it. And the thing is, it turned out we didn't know the extent of it at that particular time. It turned out that Jimmy Savile was a pedophile. He'd mess with little boys and he'd mess with little girls and things like that. Jim will fix it if they left the kids alone with Jimmy Savile, then he'd molest them. But they didn't know about it at the time. We didn't know about it. Now, he used to boast about his conquest and stuff like that with young girls, but we didn't know how young.
Yeah.
And if I'd known that, he wouldn't have left that bloody ring alive. I wouldn't have beaten him. Anyway, we went in the ring. Now, I always like to go in a ring second. I didn't like going in the ring first because the thing is, it was better for me, it was better for my opponent. If I'm wrestling with a good guy opponent and stuff like that, if he went in the ring first, people could cheer him and all the rest of it, because once I get in the ring, I don't stop performing. And if my opponent came in second, I mean, I would still be performing and doing whatever it was and getting a lot of attention. It was better if my opponent went in the ring first, got all the cheers and all that kind of stuff. Now, Ted Beresford knew that, and because I told him, forget it. Ted Beresford said to me, hey, Reedy, he said, don't forget. He said, don't underestimate Jimmy. He said he'd done his training with the Royal Marines. He said he's a real tough guy. I said, yeah, we'll see how tough he is when we get in there. I was not happy at all. Anyway, the next thing is Ted Beresford comes running. He said, "Everyone, they're playing your music. They're playing your music. You need to get in there. Jimmy's in there already." Anyway, I ran out. He wasn't in the ring. They're playing the music, and I sort of got to the top of the thing where they put the spotlight on it. The crowd had seen me, so I had to go. You know, I mean, I would run back in the dressing room if they hadn't seen me, you know.
Right.
So I went in there. So you can imagine now, I mean, my temper's boiling. I'm getting worse and worse and worse. So I've gone in there. I've gone in the ring and all the rest of it. The next thing is they play all this, some music and everything like that, that Jimmy Savile used to play as, you know, as a disc jockey and everything. And here he comes. And damn me, he's got his hair dyed a funny color. He's got a gown on that's like a garish copy of what I wear. So he comes in and everything like that, and he's aping me. Oh, I mean, is he? You know, I mean, he's like coming in doing like an Adrian Street thing, except he can't. I mean, nobody can do it except me. But you can tell what he's trying to do and all the rest of it. So anyway, I'm not going to give him the satisfaction. I mean, all the people now want to sort of see my reaction. They want to see me getting upset. But I'm not going to do it. I'll sort of turn around. I start yawning and everything like that and looking everywhere, but not at my opponent. So I thought to myself, well, at least I'll wait until he gets his gown off. And then I'll sort of go into my act and sort of just take it away from him. You know what I mean? Anyway, he gets in there and through the corner of my eye, I can see he's taking his gown off. So, right, they announce me and I turn around, start to take my gown off. I look over at him then, like as I'm doing my thing, and damn me, he had one gown on top of another one. So I'd seen him through the corner of my eye take his gown off. The next thing is, I turn around, he's got another one on. So he's done me. I mean, the guy has done me again.
He's kind of pissing you off at this point.
can you imagine?
Yeah.
You know? And I can be very pleasant. I can be very polite. I believe in politeness. But piss me off and I can be really ignorant. Anyway, you can imagine that this guy has really, really, really pissed me off. So anyway, by the time he starts messing about and everything like that, I turn around back in the corner again. I'm going to take no notice of him. When he finally gets all his gowns, he had about four gowns on, one on top of the other. So, I mean, he's doing me while I'm in the corner, like, pretending to take no notice of him. When that bell went, Linda wasn't in the business then, but she was in the audience. When I came out and I said, "Did you see that?" She said, "Oh, good God." She said, "You look like a fox chasing a chicken." I beat him inside out, upside down. All this wispy hair he had that he'd sort of dyed, I don't know how many times. I was tearing out by the roots. All his head was bleeding. I kicked him, I smashed him, I drop kicked him so hard, it's a wonder he's still in orbit. But anyway, it must have taken me about 10 minutes before the referee stopped it and everything like that. Oh, I submitted him, and then I submitted him again. I just didn't want to let him go. But anyway, I did absolutely destroyed him, and he never, ever, ever wrestled again. Now, the funny thing is, he actually owned a club in Bournemouth and started running wrestling shows there. Now, the thing is, I was a big draw there, so he had me on the show down there whenever he could get me. Now, normally, he would be there, head cook and bottle washer, running about, you know, so everybody could see him. I never, ever saw him again in my life. Even though I was wrestling on some of the shows, on a lot of the shows that he had in the club in Bournemouth, I never saw him again.
So he was avoiding you.
Yeah.
Obviously, he didn't want to be. He didn't want to spend any time with you. He'd already had plenty of you.
never set eyes on him again. But he also, that night, he gave up wrestling, and he never ever got in a ring with anybody again.
Well, sounds like that you did the proper thing. You put him out of the business. Yeah. I can't imagine he would be foolish enough to come in there and want to try to make fun of you. He doesn't sound like a really bright guy, especially the pedophile part of it is certainly not going to get him over with anybody.
He's the luckiest guy in the world because they never really found out about it. Do you know he was made an OBE by the Queen? He was actually knighted, and he was an actual fight. This is after he was after I'd put him out of wrestling. He was actually knighted by the Queen, and he was Sir Jimmy Savile.
Oh,
but he lucked out because they didn't find out he was a pedophile. Do you know how he got away with it? He'd already died.
So nobody knew until he was gone that he had been a pedophile.
Yeah. He was never actually charged with anything because they'd have had to dig him up first.
Well, that makes it even better that you beat the hell out of him. you know? Yeah. I mean, at least he got what he had coming from one person anyway.
Yeah.
So that was the main question I had to finish it. Do you have anything, Jeff, about his time in Europe before we kind of move on to America here?
Well, first of all, I have to say, part one, Adrian, it was like getting a history lesson on the British Isles. And I, speaking on behalf of myself, I really enjoyed just the history lesson that you gave everyone from your time in Britain. So moving on from there to the United States and to North America, you came over, was it 1981 you came over, Adrian?
It was 1981. I went from Britain to Canada. I wrestled in Canada for a little bit. Then I got a deal I couldn't sort of refuse in Germany. So I wrestled for Stu Hart for about 4 months, and I got a better deal in Germany. So I went to the German tournaments in Hanover for 2 months. That's how long the thing was. Then I went back to Canada, but I didn't like Stu. I didn't like his kids. I didn't like the territory.
So I guess what I was asking, though, I don't mean to interrupt, what played in your decision to leave the, you know, Great Britain and stuff like that? I mean, was it just you felt like you'd done everything you could do there and you just wanted to try something new? What made you decide to leave?
The reason was, as far as I'm concerned, Britain, up until about a year or so before I left, I would say for wrestling, it was the best place ever. I've never been anywhere where the actual wrestling was better than the old golden age of British pro wrestling. But Max Crabtree, I think I've told you something about that before. Max Crabtree, who was a good small-time promoter, he was an excellent small-time promoter. They give him the whole thing, give him the power and everything like that. And he brought his big, fat, horrible brother back out of retirement after he'd been retired for 10 years and built him up by fixing matches where he actually beat credible, like really credible wrestlers. And that's how he got his credibility, by beating guys who were known to be really, really good. I mean, it is the logic, oh, well, you know, I mean, if he beat that guy, he must be good. But anyway, I mean, it was horrible. He turned the business into a cartoon. And instead of being so, so proud of being a pro wrestler, I start becoming ashamed. In a cockeyed way, they did me a favor because I didn't want to be associated with that anymore. It was a joke. It was a cartoon. And eventually they took it off TV because, first of all, people really loved it. They saw guys being beaten who they'd never seen beaten before. And they actually believed that Big Daddy was a wrestler. He's never been a wrestler.
Now, this obviously had to impact the guys that were also over there, like Mark Rocco and Tony St. Clair, guys like that.
Oh, they were good, especially Tony St. Clair. Tony St. Clair and his brother Roy St. Clair, they were amongst the best wrestlers I've ever seen. And it's no wonder they were, because their dad was like one of the old-time wrestlers, St. Clair Gregory. He was one of one of the best wrestlers that's ever been in Britain, like for the real old time. Like, I mean, way before my time. They were great wrestlers. And there was people like that was having to lose to Big Daddy and everything like that. And it just wasn't right. So, like I say, I became ashamed of being a pro wrestler over there. So in a cockeyed way, they did me a favor because I decided to leave Britain and come over to the States. And I've got to say, it's one of the best things. It's one of the best career moves I ever made in my life. And I made far more money in the States than I was ever making in Britain. Because that's one thing that wasn't good about Britain. Getting money out of the promoters was like trying to get blood out of a stone.
So it was a lot different then, Adrian. In Britain, the promoters they weren't paying very well. You know, and I never worked there, obviously, but sure would have liked to. But, you know, it sounds like to me it was a good time to come there.
you would have been good. There were some very, very good Canadian and American wrestlers that came over to wrestle in Britain. You know, I mean, people like Luther Lindsay.
Don Leo
Jonathan was going to come over. He was billed to come over, and he was actually billed like he'd be coming over soon. And I was so excited about it because the thing is, he was one of my idols when I was about 12 years of age, 11 or 12 years of age. I was so excited he was coming over, but unfortunately, his wife died. His first wife died. I mean, I met his second wife, but his first wife died just as he was about to come over, and I put pay to that. I never did meet him until the night before Linda and I got married in the Cauliflower Alley Wrestling Reunion Club in Las Vegas. And I only met him the night before, the same night I proposed to Linda, and I was going to get married in the very next day if she said yes. But I met him the night before, and he agreed to be my best man.
Oh, geez, what a heck of a deal. You know, he was my idol, too. I mean, because of my height, once I started getting tall, and he was probably one of the best tall wrestlers ever.
He could wrestle like a lightweight. And I mean, the guy was, what, 6'6", 6'7", weighed over 300 pounds. I mean, he weighed between 280 and 300 and something. Like his weight ranged in that sort of thing. That guy could do nip-ups. He could jump off the ropes. He could drop kick somebody right on top of their head. You know, I mean, the guy was one of the most exceptional wrestlers ever.
I thought so myself.
And what a nice guy he was, too.
Yeah, never got to meet him. You know, I would have loved to. So you're into America. We talked a little bit about last time. We talked a little bit about being in Los Angeles. Obviously, we talked about Stu up there in Canada. I think you mentioned a little bit about, did you go to Oregon? Do you ever work for Don Owens any in Oregon?
No. I came close to going there, but never did. That was one of the options I had. But once I actually got over, like the word goes round and everything like that in the States, you know, I mean, in those days, there was like different places all over. I wanted to work in different places. And one of the main reasons I would have liked to go to Oregon is the fact that I love the woods and the forests. And there's a lot of them up that way, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to see it from that point of view. Linda and I traveled over to Vancouver. We actually took a vacation on Vancouver Island. We took a 23-hour train ride from Calgary to Vancouver, and we went over to Vancouver Island where we spent most of our holiday. And then we got on a train, took 23 hours back. We went right through the Rockies.
Oh, that's a beautiful trip.
I love mountains. I love mountains and forests and trees and nature. You know, I love anything like that. You know, I mean, this business has been wonderful for me because, like, not only have I've been in the jungles in Africa, I've been all over Africa, North Africa, Egypt, Gambia, Zambia, Senegal, Ethiopia. I've been all over those places, wrestled all over those places. I actually won my first world title in Zambia, in Lusaka, in Zambia. And there I met a big game hunter. I was actually staying with him. He had a ranch. I was actually staying at his ranch for most of the time I was in Zambia. And he took me, when everybody else went home, I stayed there with him for a couple more weeks. And he took me big game hunting and everything like that out in, and oh, I loved it. I filmed hyenas hunting, zebra and those little hunting dogs and things like that, elephants and things like that all over the place. And I found out, I was like kind of disappointed with myself in a way because I'm a big meat eater. I love to eat meat. I feel like that's what made me strong. But turns out I really did not like hunting animals. I mean, I kept on saying to myself, now don't be a hypocrite. You eat meat, so you should be prepared to get it. And I forced myself to shoot beautiful animals, and it upset me. I'd almost cry, like, to sort of shoot a gazelle, an antelope. I'd keep on saying to myself, don't be a hypocrite. You eat meat, you should be prepared to hunt it.
Yeah.
I'm no Nimrod. I don't like killing animals. I like photographing them and filming them, but I don't like killing them. But I must admit, I'm a hypocrite because I do like eating them.
Yeah, but, it's pretty difficult to shoot an animal for a lot of people. I can definitely identify with that. So when you were in America, did you work for Watts in Mid-South some?
Did I work for who?
Bill Watts in Mid-South.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You worked there. How did you find that to be?
I like Bill, actually. There's not many people do, but I do. I like Bill.
I like him as well. I think Bill's a heck of a guy.
Yeah.
And how was that experience for you? How'd you like working there in Mid-South?
I liked it as far as I made really good money there. But the thing I didn't like too much was I was driving anywhere between 2,500 and 4,000 miles a week when I was there. And I guess you know, the roads there are bloody awful.
Yeah. they probably were in that time frame for sure.
Yeah. The roads were really bad. And I mean, I'd work out, I'd go to the gym whenever I could, but it was hard. It was hard to get out sleeping. I mean, for example, there was like every other week we do a thing where we drive down to Baton Rouge. I was living in Pineville at the time. I drive from Pineville down to Baton Rouge. I'd wrestle there. And when I finished wrestling, I wouldn't have time to take my clothes off and have a shower. I'd put a tracksuit on of the stuff I just wrestled in. I'd be wiping makeup off my face while I'm driving the car. I'd drive all the way past my apartment in Pineville, near Alexandria, on the way up to, was it Shreveportland? Yeah, on the way up to Shreveport. We drive right past Shreveport, right up to, I think it was Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we wouldn't get there. We'd drive all through the night. We wouldn't get there until the next morning. The next morning, early afternoon. We just about have time to go and have a cup of coffee in a restaurant across the road from the arena. Have a cup of coffee, go in there. I'd be wearing the same sweaty clothes that I'd been wearing all night while I've been driving to go into the ring with. I'd put some more makeup on, whatever I'd wiped off, go in the ring and wrestle. Whenever we'd finish wrestling, there was an afternoon show. I wouldn't be able to take my clothes off again. Put my tracksuit on, jump on there, then I drive up to Oklahoma City to wrestle in the nighttime. After that, I'd actually be able to take my clothes off and have a shower and put my proper clothes on. Then I'd drive all through the night. We wouldn't get back to my apartment until about 10, 11 o'clock the next morning. We'd get something to eat, lay on the bed for about an hour and a half. Then I'd have to jump in the car and drive down to New Orleans for the show that night. And that's what we were doing. I mean, it was. And then when you did TV for him, like the actual TV show up in Shreveport, you do about three or four shows, about three or four television shows, all one after the other. So I'd wrestle there three or four times in one afternoon. Then, whenever the show was over, you'd have to dive in the car and drive off to some show there for the evening. It was
crazy.
I mean, it was crazy. Bill Dundee, they made Bill Dundee into the booker. Very wisely, he wanted to wrestle, and he wanted to do the thing like he did in Tennessee. But Bill Watts very wisely wouldn't let him. He said, no, he said, you can be a booker. I don't want you to wrestle. Don't want you as a wrestler. Anyway, I was supposed to be wrestling with Terry Taylor. I'd already taken the title off Terry Taylor. I was supposed to be wrestling with him, but he was ill. And Bill Dundee put himself in instead. And it was being televised. And he thought that, you know, once Bill Watts saw him wrestling with me, because I wrestled him all over Tennessee and we used to have a good match, did he change his mind and let him wrestle? But anyway, he got real bloody sticky and stuff like that. He got real awkward when I was wrestling with him because he wanted to put himself over. Anyway, I decided I wouldn't have it and I beat the crap out of Bill Dundee.
You weren't the first.
But he fired me the same night, so that was the end of me wrestling for Bill Watts. When I spoke to Bill Watts again, he said that should never have happened. He said, because he said, I wanted to bring my boys into wrestling. He said, bro, I wanted them to really be able to shoot. He wanted me to teach his boys. He wanted me to teach his two sons how to wrestle, you know, how to shoot wrestle.
Right.
But anyway, that didn't happen. But I'm still in touch with Bill sometimes.
He's a good guy. In actual fact,
he's a Facebook friend.
That's cool. You know, he worked for me with USA, the last company I had after I sold Continental. I went back to Knoxville, and Bill and his son, one of his sons, came over, and they were there for me. For about 6 months, I ran that company, and then I sold it to the same people that bought Continental from me. But Bill's a good guy. First met him in Australia in 1973 when he was just getting started. And he really came to Tennessee and never left. I mean, he made a home for himself there. And, you know, I didn't know that he was booking for Bill. But, you know, I think Bill's right in that situation. It's hard to be a booker and not want to put yourself over. And not want to, you know, push yourself. And that was you know, Bill had plenty of good talent. He didn't need more good wrestlers. He needed a booker, obviously. You know, Bill used to do a lot of that himself. But, you know, sounds like Bill Dundee made a little mistake there by wanting to get himself over at your expense. So then... let's talk a little bit. It must have been about after that time frame you came to Continental. I think it was around 85.
I wrestled again in Tennessee, and they brought in Renesto. Yeah, Tom Renesto was the booker there because, I mean, Bill Dundee wasn't there anymore. He was still booking for Bill Watts. And Tom Renesto was the booker. Do you remember Tom Renesto?
Oh, I definitely do. Yeah, one of the assassins booked. When I started in wrestling in 1970, he was the booker in Georgia. Him and Jody Hamilton were the assassins there. And he was a really good booker. I mean, my experience with Renesto was he was a very sharp booker. He was there during the war for Atlanta that started in about 1972, the battle for Atlanta. And when Ray Gunkel died and his wife opened up her own company against the NWA organization that was there. I mean, it got a lot of history. Tom Renesto and I go back a long way.
Tom Renesto was a booker matchmaker in for Mike LaBelle in California. That's where I first met him.
Right.
But we were good friends and everything. But whenever he was the booker for Jerry Jarrett, whenever he was a booker for him, he was okay at first, but then he flipped his lid. He didn't know what was going on half the time. In actual fact, I had to corner him one time. He had about a month and a half's wages for me. I said, show me where I've signed for it. Anyway, he said, I'm sure you've signed for it. And he opened his case to get this thing out where you signed for your wages. And there was about five or six wage packets in there that were mine.
He's forgotten to pay you.
That's kind of crazy. He thought he remembered that he had paid me, you know. But one of the reasons I left and came down to your territory was the fact that he forgot to book me.
He didn't put you on the charge.
All of a sudden, I wasn't booked. So I know, bugger this. I said, listen, I'm going. And Jared was all upset about it. But I said, well, there you go. I'm sorry and all that, but I'm going. You will come for me sometimes. I said, yeah. I said, but if I come for you again, I want a guarantee. And I was getting a decent guarantee off him, actually. Every match I had, whenever I went to work for him, like I'd go up and work for him for like maybe a week or two at a time. And I got a really good guarantee off him. But I came down, I wanted to check out Gulf Breeze because I'd heard about Gulf Breeze from a lot of different people. I came down there March 1984. I got hold of a realtor from Century 21, asked him to show me some property because I was going to be there. I just had 36 hours to spare before I went over to work for the NWA, WCW, they got to be the W. This is before they were WCW. But in 36 hours, I bought five properties.
So you really liked it. I mean, obviously, once you got there and you took a look at Gulf Breeze, which is just about 3 miles across the bay from Pensacola, basically, that's a beautiful little area there. It's a nice little strip of road. It's right there, runs along the bay.
At that particular time, I bought four rental apartments and a townhouse in a Bahama Bay Club.
Right.
They had a swimming pool and a gymnasium, you know, for the people who were there. But I rented all of them and went off sort of wrestling. And it wasn't until I worked for you that I actually came down and got to live in one of my own apartments.
Yeah, so I never realized you actually had property there before you ever came to work for me.
Yes.
Come down there, really liked the area and bought several different properties. And then you get in touch with me and you ended up there with me. And you did not have all those long trips, correct? Mid-South.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few like up to Knoxville and sort of stuff like that. But I mean, even those, you could really take in your stride after some of the trips I did. I mean, we did some long trips when I worked for the NWA. But, Bill Watts was... some of the shots we used to do in Britain were like ludicrous, you know what I mean? Really, I've driven from Scotland all the way down to almost a place called Red Roof, which is almost at Land's End down in Cornwall. I mean, that's like about 800 miles. About 800 miles. You wouldn't think you could drive that far in Britain, but you can. But that was just about doing me in. I mean, I couldn't even get to a gym, and I need to go to gyms and stuff, you know. I mean, I worked out for an hour in a gym today. I'll be, I won't go tomorrow because I don't go to the gym on Saturday or Sunday. But if weather permits, we'll be walking for 5 or 6 hours up the mountains that are almost bloody horizontal, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a workout.
No, I mean, almost vertical, I meant to say, not horizontal.
that's a great workout in itself.
We're off. Linda and I are often horizontal until we come back.
I'll tell you what, you look great. I mean, Adrian, I took a picture with you and Linda. I guess it's probably been about 2 years ago. And I was just, you know, you really, really kept yourself in shape, and that working out, as you say, it's not just a pastime; it's an all the time thing, you know. It gets like wrestling; it gets in your blood.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle. You know, you just got to do it. I will be 80 years of age next birthday.
Oh man, you don't look it, and there's not many 80-year-olds that have your body. It's just pretty amazing what you've done and how well you've taken care of yourself. And I guess Linda's got to have some credit for that.
There's not a lot of 40-year-olds that have Adrian's body, Ron.
Yeah, and that's the truth. I mean, you know, much less 80-year-olds. I mean, he just remarkably, it's remarkable how taken care
of. Come on, you say that to all the transvestites.
I got to tell this story. You know, when you first came to work for me, and you know, and your style was so different, not just your wrestling style, but your style and your personality is so different than other people. And you used to do this thing to me that I always got me. And you knew it always got me is when I would come in the dressing room, you would take your hand and run it down the side of my leg or my back and say, "Oh, hello." You know, you would give me that routine and I was like, whoa, you know, and it wasn't just one night. It was every night. I mean, it was when I came in, I got that same thing. And I was like, you know, I think I wrote something the other day about part one, my experience for doing this part one with you and saying that, you know, people don't know really what Adrian's all about. And I said, and he loves it. That's the way he wants it. He doesn't want you to know what he's all about. So, you know, I was really thrown off for a while. And then I finally realized, well, this is going to be the routine. So I might as well get used to it. But, you know, it's just your personality is just tremendous, Adrian. Really, really good. And, you know, once you got to Continental, I mean, you just really exploded there. I mean, people just went crazy. It was like nothing they had ever seen. I loved it because of the wrestling that you did. You always put wrestling into your matches. And I really loved that.
The thing is, I would never, never, never out and out say that I was gay or anything like that, which as it happens, as you know, I'm not. People thought I was, and I didn't mind them thinking that I was. You know, they could think what they like, but I would never ever say that I was, and I would never ever say that I wasn't.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, there was a mystery there, and while there's a mystery, you've got attention because people are talking about you. I think he is. Yeah, but what about that woman he's got with him? You know, I mean, why has he got that woman with him? Like, you know, if he's probably just got her, like, the sort of, you know, the sort of show and everything like that. And also, contrast. Mystery and contrast, I think, are great attention getters. Because the contrast was, I'd go in there, I like the commentary that some guy, I think it's some guy in Texas, I thought it really amused me. He'd go, "Wow, that Adrian Street. Wow. You know, when he's making his entrance, when he's walking to the ring, damn me, he looks like a French poodle. I mean, that guy, he looks like a French poodle when he goes in the ring. But when he gets in that damn ring and that bell goes and he goes after his opponent, damn me, he said that French poodle turns into an American pit bull."
Yeah.
And that kind of amused me, but it kind of summed it up because there's mystery, is the origin, and then there's contrast. I mean, you can't get a better contrast from a French poodle to an American pit bull.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's where you come across. I mean, you know, and that's a pretty good description of what you look like going down and what you look like when the bell rings. It's a totally different ball game at that point. And it sounds like some of the wrong guys have rubbed you the wrong way. And when they do, you never had a problem and kind of just letting them know that, hey, you, this just not the way you want to go. You don't want to go where I'm going to put you here. And and that's good. My granddad would have loved you, Adrian. My grandfather was your type. I mean, he was kind of a killer. Guys would say, "Roy seems to be so nice." And then other guys would say, "He's a killer. Don't mess with him. Don't mess with him at all. You know, you be careful around him." You know, yeah. So your personality is so good. I wanted to ask you, of all the angles, we worked all kinds of angles with you, obviously. We worked angles with a lot of the guys. That's kind of the way I like to do business. I wanted to have a great crew, a lot of great talent, and utilize all of them. So, you know, every night pretty much we'd have, if there's six matches, there's five of them that the fans really want to see, and they're angled and programmed, and, you know, it's part of the entire night's entertainment. What was one of your maybe favorite programs, angles that you worked in Continental there? Do you have anybody, did you remember any angle in particular?
Yeah, I think Rip Rogers was one that I really liked. Rip Rogers, because he'd sort of go in with the long blonde hair and he'd sort of try to do me. But I mean, the people didn't like him and they liked me. And he had Brenda Britton to sort of counteract Linda and everything like that. Yeah, I think the program that Linda and I did with Rip Rogers and his wife, Brenda Britton, I think that was my favorite. Also, when Terry Garvin, Beauty, came in with the Beast, and then he got the Baroness. That was pretty good too. Both those characters were almost like they were sort of trying to be me, but not doing it. I enjoyed those.
I like the one we did with Wendell Cooley too, where you end up putting the dress on Wendell and the makeup. Yeah. That was a pretty good one too. I mean, you know, Wendell was such a good looking guy and a country boy, and y'all end up doing that with him. It's like, I couldn't really believe that Wendell was going to go, let's do that, you know. But that was good for me too. I kind of liked that one too. It's easy to use you as a talent, because you had so much more going for you than just being there and getting in the ring and doing your thing. I mean, you made great interviews. You were a shooter. You could do whatever you needed to do. You did a whole lot of wrestling. You were so good at the matches itself and the psychology of everything. It's just a real pleasure working with you for those years. I don't remember working with many people that I really enjoyed working with as much as you, because you've been everywhere. You'd seen everything. You'd done everything. You had a feel for what it's supposed to be like, and was really, really good. Is Linda there beside you today? Is she still there today?
Yeah, she fell down on the floor. She's getting back up again.
Oh, I wanted to ask Linda another question. We asked her a couple of questions back. Hey, how are you doing, Linda?
All right, thanks. I've just been stretching out on the floor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you've probably been to the gym and you've probably walked in the mountains already today. You've had a long day. I wanted to ask you, when y'all left England, what was it like for you? How did you feel about coming to America?
I was excited. When we actually landed, which was, I think, in the night time, and we actually got on American soil, I mean, we could hardly believe it. It was absolutely fantastic. And the first thing we did, we got a taxi to find us a hotel, and it was a really nice hotel. And then we thought, oh, we've got to have something to eat. And the first little, you know, restaurant-y thing that we went into was called The Kettle. You know, one of those little diners right near a hotel and everything. And we actually sat in, I think, a corner booth, and we were looking out the window, and we saw the American flag there. We think, oh, we've made it. We've got there.
That had such an impact on me, sitting there having our breakfast and looking through the window and seeing a great big American flag flying. I tell you what, now and again, I mean, in this country, I might catch a sight of an American flag flying, and I get that excitement. I get that fear, that's a tingle in the pit of my stomach. It takes me right back to there. It meant that much to us, you know?
That's unreal. You know, it's really wonderful to hear that. You know, sometimes you don't hear people they come to this country and they don't have that type of appreciation for it and that type of feeling toward it. But y'all been everywhere. I'm sure, you know, you've been to Africa and all types of different places. So our country, you know, I'm often wondering about people, you know, that from, you know, that were born and raised in other countries and how they feel when they come here. And it's really quite flattering to hear that you guys felt like it was something special.
Oh, it's special. Like I say, it's one of the best moves that Linda and I have ever done in our lives was to leave. In spite of everybody telling me that we couldn't do it, there's no way you can't wrestle out there. You're too old. You're too small and all that kind of stuff. But the thing is, I've never, ever, somebody tells me I can't do something I want to do, it makes me even more determined. You tell me something that I'm inclined to do, you tell me I can't do it, you eat my dust, because I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it or die trying, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, that's what makes you the type of person that you are. I mean, you know, when you're talking about just things that you do, it's just truly amazing. You design clothes, you know, you've written 7 books, maybe more now. I don't know. I can't keep up with all the things you do. I mean, you write songs, you sing songs, you record songs, you paint. I know you paint. And, you know, and I don't know what all the other things that you do. I mean, you're such a talented guy and can do pretty much, I guess, you know, people told you couldn't paint and they must have said, well, you can't sing or whatever. And you've proven them wrong in that respect. And it's pretty amazing that you're as talented as you are. I remember in the backyard of my home in Gulf Breeze, you and Linda came and did a painting in the back by my pool area. And I've been to your home. You've got beautiful paintings. You know, it's just, you're just a really, really talented guy. And, you know, wonderful that you've been a wrestler. You know, it's amazing, you know, your talent in that respect, too. And now you're back in Wales. So let's talk a little bit about what it's like to go home after all those years and after you're almost 80 now, you know, and, you know, you and I have talked a little bit and I understand that, you know, you really love it there. But, you know, kind of explain and describe what that's like to have traveled all over the world and done the things you've done and to come home. And what does that feel like for you?
Well, I've always said you can take the boy out of Wales. You can't take Wales out of the boy. He's beautiful here. And I mean, Tom Jones was actually born just up the road from in a town very close to the one I was in. And like he sings, the green, green grass of home. You can't beat it, you know. It's exciting. That in actual fact, they say that in the world there's two kinds of people. There's Welsh people and people who wish they were Welsh.
Yes. Well, my last name is pretty close.
I was just going to say that. There you go. Yeah, now you can't deny it.
I'll bet
you'd rather be you than anybody else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose we're a lot of us are like that, you know. And, you know, and you know, you're pretty darn unique. I don't think there'll ever be another Adrian, probably.
Thank goodness for that. But the funny thing is, tomorrow, but every third week, my only sister and brother-in-law come to this town to do their shopping. They do it every third week. 1 week they go to Ebervale, I think. Another week they go to Cardiff. And then the third week they come here. And they always come to visit me. What they don't realize is they come in tomorrow to visit me. They don't realize that when they actually come, I'm going to put a big spread on for them and everything like that. We always have to prepare a meal for them. for tomorrow, it's going to be really special. Lobster tails and Chateaubriand and the best wine and everything like that. And the reason for that is tomorrow it'll be exactly 2 years since I moved into the new house that we bought.
Right.
They probably don't remember that, but I do. We actually moved into this house I'm living in now. And I tell you what, the view that we've got from here is insane. I don't know if I told you last time. There's a window over there. If it was light, you know, I mean, it's dark here now. But if it was light, I can actually see over into England. We're living in Wales, right?
Oh, geez.
We can see the Bristol Channel. We can see right over the Bristol Channel into England from here.
Oh, geez, man. Must be beautiful.
We can see all the ports and stuff like that. Now, there's the Severn Bridge. There's two Severn Bridges, the old Severn Bridge and the new Severn Bridge. Is a bridge that actually goes from Wales into England. We can actually see the beginning of that from this window.
Jeez, that must be beautiful.
And from the other side of the house, from our bedroom's the other side of the house from here, from our bedroom, we can see right up into the mountains, like where some of our favorite walks are. It's really steep up there. They've got a mound up there. I won't try to say it because it's Welsh. And although I'm Welsh, I don't speak the language, and it'd be hard to get my tongue around. What is it?
Trumbalum
Mound up there.
Yeah.
Actually, an old Welsh, an ancient Welsh fortress. But it looks like a big mound and everything up there now. But they actually built that when the Romans tried to invade.
Gee,
nobody's really been successful in conquering the people in South Wales. They conquered them in North Wales, and the people in North Wales have always resented the people in the South, because most of us in the South don't speak Welsh. They speak Welsh up there. Some of them can't even speak English. But they call us the other Welsh.
Yeah, sounds like
they don't regard us as real Welsh. But the reason for that is they were beaten by the Anglo-Saxons. We never were.
Right.
The people in South Wales have never been completely conquered.
That's a great fact. That's amazing. Yeah. I don't know much about that area, but yeah, I have seen some pictures that you put on Facebook and stuff like that, and it's beautiful. I can tell it's really, really a beautiful place.
You know, the thing is, from that side, we can see like the beginning of some of the trails and things like that. They go up into the hills. From my front door, it takes us 10, 15 minutes to be on the beginning of the trails. But then from there, it goes up, 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 and then it goes up some more.
Oh, geez.
Yeah,
that's got to be great exercise, and as good as the gym.
Yeah. Oh, but the thing is, if we go out, you go like so far, and you get like a choice of half a dozen different trails. Right, whatever trail you take, eventually, all along the way, you come to different trails, and if you follow any of them, you come to half a dozen more different trails. And if you go right over the top there, there's valley after valley after valley.
Jeez.
I tell you what, if you've been up there a little bit earlier, I tell you what, they can hold their head up with places like, what's the place in America now we went to see the leaves?
Oh, Vermont.
Yeah. Vermont. To me, some of the trails that we've been on and some of the views would equal Vermont. I love it.
We got a few more minutes here. Jeff, do you have any other questions for Adrian?
Well, Adrian, first of all, we referenced Bill Dundee a little bit earlier. And since Ron and I, our show is on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about some time that you spent in Memphis with one of our Arcadian brothers. Please regale us with some stories about a young Jim Cornette being your manager in Memphis.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, Jim Cornette used to come to the shows and take photographs of the boys, and the boys would buy photographs of him. But then he also had a sideline, like he'd sell them to the fans as well, you know. But I've still got, I've probably got 100 photographs or more that was taken by Jim Cornette at that particular time. But then they actually decided they were going to make him into a manager. And the first group of people that he managed, they called the Cornette Dynasty. And he used to sort of say, like, oh, he's got his money from his mother and all that kind of stuff. His mother this and his mother that. And the first people ever in his dynasty was Apocalypse. I was like a hippie boy that started a new gimmick, called himself Apocalypse. And he had like all the funny camouflage makeup and everything on his face.
And Jesse Barr also, right?
Jesse Barr and Linda and myself. We were the first people ever to be managed by Jim Cornette.
So did you enjoy him? Because the story always goes that the reason that Jerry Jarrett made Jimmy a manager was he said if he can get as much heat with the crowd as he's got with the boys in the locker room, he's going to get over like $1 million.
I like that one.
He can definitely talk. I mean, he gets more attention with his mouth than most wrestlers can get with their whole body.
Oh, that's good.
So let me ask you along another line. You know, when you were on World of Sport and you were, you know, one of the main attractions with there, you know, it leads us to wonder with the gimmick that you had as the exotic Adrian Street, whether or not as part of pop culture that didn't start to bleed into the whole, you know, David Bowie doing Ziggy Stardust and glam rock and all that. What did you think about that?
If you look on my face page, you'll find all kinds of articles from Huck magazine, this magazine, that magazine, this newspaper. And they all admit that a lot of those people copied. I truly think that David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust was a copy of me. I mean, even had the lightning bolt on his face. Mark Bolan, for instance, during an interview, they asked him, you know, Mark Bolan from T-Rex, they said, where did you get your ideas and everything like that for your makeup and the costumes that you wear on stage? And he said, from watching Adrian Street Wrestling on TV. So, I mean, he actually said it. Elton John actually tried to buy one of my suits that I designed. In a store in Chelsea, Kings Road, Chelsea, Granny Takes a Trip, he actually tried to buy one of my suits. I was actually on tour in Zambia in Africa at that particular time. He tried to buy one of my suits, and the guy said, can't possibly sell you that. You know, it belongs to Adrian Street. Well, Elton John knew exactly who I was because he used to go to a club with Long John Baldry, with Jonathan King, with Rod Stewart. They all used to go to this club and they had their own little corner there, a little gay corner. And you'd say hello to them and they'd say hello, but I never bothered to talk to him or anything like that. But he knew exactly who I was and he agreed he wouldn't. But then the thing is, he went and I had Birds of Paradise made in rhinestones and sequins and things like that down the sleeves and down the outside of the trousers. In actual fact, I've still got the suit and it still fits me. It was actually the suit that Linda and I got married in. But I actually had that suit made to measure in 1969 and I've still got it and it's still as good as new.
And still fits.
how it still fits.
That's the most important thing.
I mean, listen to that. I mean, how many guys can say that? Not too many, I don't think, can say a suit that they've had that long but, they can still get themselves into.
He had a suit made that was very similar, except instead of Birds of Paradise down the outside of the legs and sleeves, he had musical notes, which is more appropriate to his line of work.
So I've got another one. I want to ask you, I saw somewhere where Bob Dylan, now we're talking about an American singer, he does paintings. I guess he has he called it revisionist art. And I think one of you either did a painting of you or it referred to you.
Yeah, Bob Dylan and I, I've never met, but we're apparently fans of each other.
Super.
And he painted 30 paintings, and these 30 paintings are in a gallery in New York. I can't remember the name of the gallery now, but it's a very famous gallery in New York, and they've got 30 of his paintings. Now, he is a wrestling fan because he's also painted John Tolles. He's also painted, who's the pencil neck geek? Who's the guy now that?
Freddie Blassie.
He's also, I got Freddie Blassie on the front of him, he's painted everybody as if they're in magazines. You know, as if it's a magazine cover. For instance, he's painted Sharon Stone, and it looks like she's on the front cover of Playboy. The painting he's done of me, it looks like it's on the front of Rolling Stone. And he's called the painting Glam Rock Takes Over the Metal Glam Rock, or something like that anyway, about glam rock. And that's the title he's given me. So, I mean, he sort of kind of recognized me as what I was doing and what I was. And I've actually got that painting. I mean, I could message you that painting now if it came to the push.
So, Adrian, in your own way, you can honestly say that you've finally made the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. That's a heck of a deal right there. No, no. Hey, you're just a tremendous guy to talk to, Adrian. You've just got so much going for yourself, and I miss you guys. I miss you and Linda. You know, we really got close. I really enjoyed knowing y'all. The fact that you came there, the fact that you became a part of that community there in Gulf Breeze and in that area. Just people there. I enjoy you from all over the world, basically, and we're kind of about running out of time here, but I want to give you a chance to plug whatever that you would like to talk about. I mean, there are so many things I have found about you that I didn't know about. I know that you have a documentary. I guess it's a documentary, and it says, "You may be pretty, but I am beautiful." That's the Adrian Street story. Is that... That aired in April, correct?
Yeah, that one was done by Joanne Randles, and she's in the process of doing a feature movie on me, and the feature movie is going to be called Adrian. The WWE also did a documentary on me. That's called Imagine What I Could Do to You, that the same title as my song. They've got that on their network. I think you can probably watch it on Netflix or something like that. I know it's on a network. Yeah. I mean, anybody that wants to see the one that WWE did can get that. We just found out actually that the BBC over here want to run Joanne Randles. You may be pretty, but I'm beautiful. They're going to run now. We're just waiting for a date.
What about the sequence, the Sadist in Sequence? Where's that one, and how can they find that?
The Sadist in Sequence is a song that's on my first album. That's my first album, actually. That's a CD of my first album.
Right.
It's also on vinyl. And it's also on cassette.
called Shake, Wrestle, and Roll, correct?
Yeah, Shake, yeah. Wrestle, and Roll. That's my first album. My second album is Naughty, But It's Nice. But anybody who wants to listen to any of the songs I've done, they're all on Spotify. Burger Records, who's brought these, who's brought them out again, they put them all on Spotify, so you can, anybody can go on Spotify and listen to everything, as well as you can actually get the vinyl records from Burger Records from California.
Cool. Now, how about the merchandise? Do you, is there a place if people want to go and I know you've got a new doll out. And
The doll here, Adrian Street action figure. I've got to say, this is the best action figure that I've ever seen. It's even got my tattoos in detail. The detail on this is fantastic. Quite honestly, all the other action figures I've seen look like garish cartoon sort of unkind caricatures compared with this.
Right.
And on the back, this is a deluxe box. On the back is there's a space there where Linda and I sort of signed the autographs.
Oh yeah.
We're going nuts at the moment because this is something I've actually got one of these figures on top of our Christmas tree.
That's a good place for it. That's a good spot.
That's a question. It's on top of my Christmas tree. Now, is it a star or is it a fairy?
There again, see, you're still doing it. You never know. But we'll never know, will we? Adrian, this has been great, man. I don't know how to thank you and Linda enough for doing this with us.
Just seeing you and talking to you and having a laugh like we did, like we used to, that's thanks enough, mate.
Well, you know, you're very special. Linda, you're very special as well. Y'all, it's just been a pleasure. I can't imagine my life if I had not brought you in, man. I can't imagine having missed Adrian Street. You know, it's really, really, I love the hair on your doll there too. I mean, they really got you down on that doll. They've really done a tremendous job with that. You know, I can't imagine my life, like I say, if I hadn't have brought you in. You've just made my life better and thousands of other people worldwide. You know, you're a character. You're just a totally different person, and it's really just been a pleasure, man, to be able to do this program with you. And I wish y'all the very best. I know that y'all are happy. I see that in your face here on Skype. I can see that the both of you are very happy, and that makes me happy. You know, y'all are good people, and I really, really appreciate y'all being with us here and doing this program for us. And can't really thank you enough. And I want to come and see you. I want to come and take one of those walks up that mountain and just get a look at where you live there, man.
Now, wouldn't that be nice? I tell you what, the fans are going to go nuts if they see pictures of us in Wales walking up the mountain. We'll fill Facebook with it.
All right. Well, thank y'all very much, and take care of yourselves, and I will stay in touch with you.
Okay, mate. The thing is, you've made our life better too. You know, I mean, you're a hell of a nice guy, a nice, polite guy, and everything like that. And what's more, something else I appreciate, you're a bloody good wrestler too.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And, we're kind of made out of the same cloth. It's in our blood. And then we talked about that earlier, and it never will go away. Don't ever want it to go away. Why would we? And, thank you all so much for being with us, and take care of yourselves, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay, mate. Have a good one.
All right.
Give a love to all the guys.
I will. I certainly will. Everybody that I Everybody I run into, I will tell them. And thank you all very much.
Okay, have a good one.
Yeah,
all right. All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, before we leave this Super Studcast number 24, part two, which was a tremendous interview with Adrian Street, Ron, I know you have a special message for all the patrons of the Super Studcast.
Yeah, I just want to take a few minutes here, Jeff, to just thank all the patrons out there. And their support does so much for the regular Studcast. It kind of keeps us afloat here, and it gives us the opportunity to do what I do and to do these regular Studcasts that are basically telling my whole life story. But it's these Super Studcasts and the patrons out there that are supporting us and taking these Super Studcasts that kind of make it all happen. And this one is going to air on, it's going to be released on New Year's Eve, which is a great time, you know, for people to get it. And obviously, 2 weeks later, in January, around January 13th, 14th, the second Tuesday in the month will be, a new one come out again. But, just wanted to take this time to speak to the fans out there, to these wonderful patrons that we have. It's just phenomenal to me to see not just how many we have, but where they are in the different countries that people listen to the Super Studcast. And for if you're in Australia, if you're in Japan, if you're in Germany, if you're in Africa, I mean, you know, they our listeners come from everywhere. I just want to tell you how much we appreciate it. We're going into 2020. It's pretty amazing, and thank you all for being on board, and we continue to do what we do here, and once a month, we're going to try to bring you something special, like I think we have done here, hopefully, that you feel, all your patrons feel out there, that this one has been a great one, and I truly believe it is, and just with the release of part one, it's only been out for a few days, it's been phenomenal support. And phenomenal comments. So just want to thank the fans, the patrons, those people that are supporting us. And we're going to keep doing what we do. And I hope all of you have a great New Year's Eve and a wonderful 2020.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all Studcasts with your donation for this month's Super Studcast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super Studcast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super Studcast is done.